Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Moors, the Moorish Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana El Bay. And this evening, we have a very informative broadcast for you. We're going to be dealing with our ancient story abroad and coming to America. We want to get down into this and all the finer details and answer some questions and set the record straight once and for all. And my reason for listening, bringing this broadcast out is because I have listened to quite a few programs on the radio. And when I listen to these programs and they begin to talk about Egypt and Africa and stuff like that, the people that's talking about this stuff, and usually these are European programs a lot that I listen to, I discovered that they never give any indication that the Egyptians were people of African descent. So what we want to do today is we want to say what I know they meant to get around to saying, it just quite haven't gotten it yet. So just want to make sure that we get it out here today so that everybody will know the truth about our ancient story and who's who and people, places, times, and events. And that's what I want to get to. Keep in mind that we're coming back tomorrow night with part two on the biggest scam in the world, in the history of the world. We've already did part one. We come back part two with that tomorrow. So make sure you tune in. And I also want to add that I had done a broadcast yesterday on high frequency radio. For those of you who didn't catch that, all you have to do is go to my website at newdebtelimination.com, and right there on the home page under the red writing, you'll see my widget there, and that's that broadcast in its entirety. And what we dealt with is exercising your freedom of right to travel. And I want you to go in there and check that out, and pay close attention to the sister that called in, who also was able to exercise her freedom and right to travel successfully. And she describes how she did that, and so do I. Also, in the chat room, I just put a link in there, and I know I was telling you at our last broadcast, the biggest scam in the history of the world, there was a free book that I wanted you to get, and we have put the link to that. I was misquoting it. The title of it is Death of Money. .com. That's www.deathofmoney.com. And so you can go over there and get your copy of that. The only thing you do is pay a little $4.95 for shipping, and they'll send you that book. And the link is right here in the chat room. It just is described for you, so make sure you get a hold of that. Okay. Now, we're going to be bringing some very informative, detailed information so that we can set the record straight. And we can check out the man's credentials that's going to be delivering this information. And I want you all to pay attention. Keep in mind the phone lines are open. We will also be coming to you in the future with a broadcast involving your astrological signs and stuff. We did that on high frequency radio as well, but we're going to come back and we're going to do that over here on Morris Talk Live 100. So make sure that when you see this advertisement, make sure you dial in, have your birth numbers ready, and have your time of day of birth and all that good stuff, and call on into the broadcast so we can do your look at your zodiac things. If you want me to read that on the air for you, we'll be more than happy to do that for you. Okay. And I just want to give you those announcements. We will also be coming back dealing with the sisters. And, you know, what's the good black woman supposed to look like? What's she supposed to be like? We're gonna deal with that and put that information out there to you. So watch out for that particular broadcast. We're going to take a little quick commercial break. And when we come back, we're going directly into this thing, okay?
Y'all understanding know. Contract law takes on greater significance when we learn how to use it to eliminate our debts. Visit us at newdebtelimination.com. That's newdebtelimination.com. Or call me, Tahaka, toll-free, 877-647-2071. That's toll-free, 877-647-2071. One of the best-kept secrets in the country is learning how to formulate your own contracts and the use of such to eliminate your debt. Go to newdebtelimination.com. That's newdebtelimination.com. Or call me, Tahaka, toll-free, 877-647-2071.
Okay, we're going to start now, and I want you to pay very close attention as we bring the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help us God, in regards to who is who and what is what in Africa and the Americas. We want to deal with that as well. We're going to be coming to America with this information, and we're going to turn over as many stones as we possibly can. So I want you all to sit back.
Here and goes this way, which means it flows from south to north. So it's going downhill when we go this way. That means it's going uphill to go this way. The ancient Kemites always looked back this way, up river, as the source of their home, their inspiration, and so forth. For example, for them, the word south and face were the same. The word left and east are the same. The word right and west are the same. So their general orientation was to the south with their back to the North Pole.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what they used as their main point of orientation. We must keep that in mind.
Okay.
This would be an example of the Nile River, for example, which is very interesting in Kemet. One of the beauties of this river is that they have winds that blow from the north going south, so that if you want to go north, you just float. If you want to go south, you get help from the wind. And so that was helpful, because if you floated one way, you wanted to be able to get back.
Okay,
the fifth principle or master key, fifth concept, organizing concept, is that the origin of the people and the culture, like the orientation, is also up south. So we look, in order to show this, for a cultural unity between the Kemetic people and the Sudanese people, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that great Egyptologist, E. Wallace Budge, used to say that he felt that he understood the Kemetic writing better, and at least the Kemetic religion was understood better by him when he studied the religion of Sudanese people. The further south he went and watched the religion that was being practiced at that time, the better he understood the ancient Kemetic religion. So in other words, you didn't go to Saudi Arabia or to Europe and study those religions to try to understand Kemetic religion, because they were not like the Kemetic religion. The cultural unity was between Kemet and the people up south. The sixth organizing principle is that generally significant leaders are southern. And I'm going to go to the time chart on this again. Those who founded, just watch this, for example. Those who founded, the king who founded Dynasty One was a southern king, Mina. The kings...
When you say southern, you're talking about...
That means he came from up south. That means he would come from the area today that we call somewhere near Luxor, even some cases as far south as Aswan, sometimes even outside the country. But what I'm saying is that each of the founding dynasty plus the dynasties of the four golden ages...
Which are
the Old Kingdom or the Pyramid Age, the Middle Kingdom or the Literary Age, the New Kingdom or the Temple and Imperial Age, the Late Kingdom or the Revival Age, each of these four golden ages was initiated from the south. In other words, their king, their family, the royal family at that time came from the south. That's a very important fact.
Who were clearly black.
Because they were then black and they are now black, even in 1990. The Luxor population is a black population, and definitely when you get to Aswan, that's a black population.
Okay,
the Imperial Age was centered at Waset. The Restoration Age was centered at Waset. And Meroe, which is even further south than Waset, it's even out of the country. Meroe is all the way up almost to Sudan or Khartoum.
I like that name, Waset. I wonder, what does that mean?
It means the scepter. How do you like the
there's
name, some, Waset?
There's something about it. I don't know. What. It means the scepter. Now, you got to tell
scepter.
Us what that means.
Waset, of course, today is called Luxor.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, the Greeks called it Thebes, but the Africans called it Waset. And Waset meant the scepter, the symbol of authority and rulership and power.
Okay.
The literary age was started at Waset. The priesthood at Waset was the home base of the preachers. You know, they
and, why, were, and why is that significant?
It's very important because you had this peculiar kind of thing where what Plato was striving for in his Republic, the idea of philosopher king, was a reality in Kemet, that the priests were the ones that disciplined royalty. In other words, the pharaoh, contrary to what many people believe, did not have a free reign, that he had to gain, in effect, the approval of the high priest of the time. And so this high priesthood had as its center base Waset, and from there, subsidiary lodges would be found all over the country, especially from the 11th dynasty onward.
Okay.
Prior to that time, of course, they had several major centers.
Okay.
Okay, this is one of our first pharaohs, early pharaohs, and of course this is the pyramid pharaoh, Djoser, who built the step pyramid and whose funerary complex we looked at before that had those so-called Greek columns. We can see clearly here this is an African man.
Okay.
If we skip from Djoser to this pharaoh, we have skipped from the Old Kingdom to the Middle Kingdom, and this is the pharaoh who founded the Middle Kingdom. The second golden age, and it was from Waset that this family lived and ruled, and that was Dynasty 11, Mentuhotep II. He's a very important pharaoh, but several other important pharaohs also lived in this same city of Waset, and they also were critical not only to Kemet, but also to other parts of the world, such as this one. This is Pharaoh Senwosret I, who is known in history, according to Martin Bernal, who wrote the book Black Athena. This is the pharaoh who is the legendary Greek figure He's a comedic figure, but the Greeks referred to him as Cecrops. His name in comedic is Kepercare Senwosret I. And he is the one that Bernal credits with the founding of the Greek city-state of Athens. So that there is this external relationship between Kemet and the rest of the world as far back as 2000 B.C. This is in the Middle Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we have in that same kingdom a pharaoh who is also known to the Greeks, according to Martin Bernal's work and others. His name is Amenemhat III. And Amenemhat III is that legendary character who fought with Agamemnon in the Trojan War. In the Greek-Trojan War, we had Ethiopian troops, and Greeks call Kemetic people and other Africans black people, and the word for that in Greek was Ethiopian. So this is the figure. Here he is again, Amenemhat III. And Amenemhat III is the legendary Memnon of the Greeks.
Okay.
Nefertari is the queen mother of the third golden age. She was married to Pharaoh Ahmes, or she's sometimes referred to as Amhos Nefertari. You can see that she's clearly black, but she's also a part of that Waset family, this up-south family, showing again the southern origin of leadership. Mm-hmm. And so here you have this key dynasty, the 18th, which is sometimes called the Grand Golden Age, the biggest of all the four golden ages, the age of imperial expansion, the age of architectural expansion, and so forth. So she would be one of the major figures illustrating this point about the up-south nature of the leadership. Okay, here we have Pharaoh Amenhotep III with his wife, Queen T. This is the mother and father of Pharaoh Akhenaten, who was married to Nefertiti. Most of the people who know Kemet, they know about Nefertiti. But they should really know about Nefertiti's in-laws, because they were really important people, especially the wife. The wife is Queen T, and Queen T is the woman who literally ruled Kemet along with her husband, co-regent with her husband. There are letters from Asian kings in cuneiform where when they got into some difficulty, this is the woman they asked for help. They didn't write to her husband, they wrote to her, so that you could say that she was a co-regent with her husband.
Okay. Now, we're just getting started. I want you to pay close attention to the identity that's being spoken of here in regards to the people that were actually the rulers of the land, their identity. And I know that the on a lot of the broadcasts that I listen to and stuff, I listen to Coast AM, and I know they probably have been meaning to get around to it, and but they just haven't mentioned the fact that these people were Africans. Okay, they were black people, and I know they'll probably be going to get to it, and we'll just wait patiently and until they do, because I was listening one night, and I had a young man call in, and this was a brother, because this guy, he had been talking for almost an hour about Egypt and not mention not one single time that they were black people. It was as if the guy was saying, well, you know, what else did we do? And I was like, we? What are you talking about? You didn't do nothing. You wasn't even there. He was still housed in the Caucasus region. And we're going to deal with that at a later broadcast, too. But y'all
use the term Kemet rather than the term Egypt, because that is the name that the Kemetic people use to refer to themselves. The name Egypt was used by Greek people and is therefore a foreign name, not a native African or a native Egyptian name.
Lister Velt Middleton, one of the leading educational television producers on African history.
Why is ancient Kemet so important to the world and to black people, African people in particular?
Ancient Kemet is important because it's humankind's oldest civilization. It's the development of the best effort of a group of people to organize themselves. And for Africa, that's especially important since African people have been so defamed, even to the extent that some have said that African people had no civilization. In fact, African people developed the first civilization, which was Kemet. It is as important to African people as Greece is to European people.
What did these Africans develop in the way of science? And
well, of course, in the development of civilization, we would refer to Kemet as a high technical civilization. The sciences, as we know them, were well advanced in Kemet, thousands of years before they had that kind of development before. The art of writing, astronomy, music, any area that we now consider to be an important academic area already had its beginning in Kemet, and it was very well developed.
Now, you know, a lot of African Americans watching this will say now, what do the descendants of African slaves in the United States have to do with these ancient Africans in Kemet or Egypt?
Well, it's important for any group of people to have a sense of, or to have the ability to answer three questions about themselves. And these questions are Booker T. Washington Coleman, a Washington, D.C. historian's questions that he uses in organizing his educational experiences for children. He says, every human being ought to be able to answer the question, who am I? Where in the world am I? How in the world did I get here? Mm-hmm. Now, most well-developed nations spend millions, maybe billions of dollars answering those questions for themselves. That's why you have Smithsonian Institution for the United States. That's why you have libraries. That's why you have universities that invest in history departments and so forth. African people have almost forgotten because we haven't had the resources to take care of that part of our existence. It is the knowledge of one's history that gives a strong sense of belonging and identity, which provides the basis for group unity, which provides the basis for political and economic power.
Mm-hmm. What is the connection, the genetic connection, the cultural connection between the Africans who are now in the United States and those of ancient Kemet or Egypt?
Well, it's fairly clear that the pattern of movement of people on the African continent, and it moves from...
we'll go to the map.
It moves from beginnings here in the Nile Valley beginnings,
okay,
where the Nile River actually starts right here, and it will go down here, joined by another Nile, the Blue Nile coming from Ethiopia, the White Nile coming from here, joining here and coming this way. So the migration pattern of human beings was down this river into Egypt, and then there were migration patterns over into West Africa many times, and some of the time the migration actually went from Egypt into across the top of the Sahara and into these parts. And we believe there are people here now who are quite similar, and probably, as was said in the book by Felix Du Bois, Timbuktu the Mysterious, they're probably both the cultural and the genetic descendants of the people of Egypt, and they're the Dogon people here in Mali.
Let me ask you to go over that again just to make sure that get all of
it. Okay, early man begins here in this area. Somewhere.
And we're talking about the cultural connection, the genetic connection.
We're talking about the people first, the genetic connection, and then, of course, they carry their culture down the river. These were black people here. They carry their culture down the river before they went out and populated the rest of the earth. Then, of course, they migrated not only north, but they also migrated from here out in the parts of West Africa into the south. They then also migrated from Egypt, which is here, or Kemet, as we should call it, across the Sahara into areas of West Africa. Mali would be a case in point.
Okay. Now, some African-American parents will say, our children are maiming each other. Our children are on drugs. And here you are talking about ancient African history. Why is this relevant? How do you respond to that?
It's one of the major pieces. It's not the only piece. You can't say that if someone takes a course in chemotology that they will stop drugs tomorrow. But you can say that if a group of people has no sense of being a part of the historical world, that is, if we see ourselves as mere spectators, that we just sat on the sidelines as the march of humanity went by, that has an effect on how you live your life. And one way we know this is that we watch what happens when children and adults learn this information about African people. The difference in attitude, the difference in self-esteem, self-concept, self-image, you can almost see those things change before your very eyes.
What are you seeing? What have you seen?
Well, I get letters from young men in prison who, upon reading some of the works of great African historians and seeing some of the illustrations that we have to offer, who are abruptly shocked, changed, and almost put on a new mission. They almost take up a new purpose, and I have many letters like this, as well as people who are well-educated, people in universities and colleges who have spent 20 and 30 years in their discipline, but when they learn this information, they talk about having a transformation experience, and they are very explicit about how these things affect them. So, you know, we have abundant examples of how this works, and it would be really wonderful to figure out a way to be able to show that.
Okay. Now, master keys to the interpretation of data on Kemet. What is this concept of master keys, and how did you arrive at it?
Okay, the idea of a master key is simply that in the face of the fact that there is so much information on ancient Kemet, so much information on Africa for that matter, and it comes to us in bits and pieces, like little episodes. In order to give a sense of order and coherence to it, it's necessary to identify certain key concepts, key principles, guiding ideas that will organize all of this information so that it makes some sense to the person who is trying to comprehend
it. It's a study tool.
It's a study tool, a guide for the analysis of information. Right.
Okay. Let's take a look at the first graphic.
Kemetic culture was pre-dynastic. Let me go to the timeline for this because it's...
Okay. Let us wait a minute for the time, for the... Okay.
Okay, here we have a time chart that shows this line here, which is a line that starts way before 3000 BC, and it comes to a period of time after Christ. And this is the line of culture showing that the way of life of the ancient Kemites remained the same for over 3,000 years. This, of course, is their political control. Now, these are the four golden ages of ancient Kemet. Mm-hmm. But this is the dynastic period that begins here, after which we have these four golden ages. When we say pre-dynasty,
okay. Now, they have it. He's also told us why it is so important for us to learn everything we possibly can about our own self. And he told you why it was important to other cultures and why they spend millions and millions and millions of dollars making sure that they have plenty of information about their culture and their experience and this type of stuff. And what you will discover is when you, if we, let's say for instance, if we got all got together and invested in an emporium, a giant library just on our culture alone, you can go into that library and look at the people, places, times, and events and discover lies that is latent pretty much just about every culture on this planet. I think that they are claiming, which simply is not true, and it lies right there in your ancient story. And so that's why I always try to encourage the brothers and sisters to learn something about your ancient story. That way you are able to have some power and have some confidence and stuff. So when somebody come up and start telling you something about Christopher Columbus and all this garbage, you can make sure you have proof to provide. So
you mean before Dynasty One, things were going on back here that are not well
before
documented.
Dynasty One,
before
which
Dynasty
was,
One, which was before the founding of Kemet as a nation.
In the year?
And this would go back as many years, we don't know. Some people say another 5,000 years. Some say another 20,000 years. In fact, the Kemetic historian Mir N. Jehudi, or Manitou, suggested that you could go back to 25,000 years at the time that Kemet was ruled by the gods and then finally by these wise people, and then finally it was organized as one nation in Dynasty One. So, for example, we know that not 3000 BC, but at 4236, or some people say 4241 BC, the calendar that we use now was already in operation in the Nile Valley. 4236 or 4241 BC, that calendar was already in place. That is an incredible thing to realize the technology, the mathematics, the number of years of observation that it would take to create that calendar. And that shows that the culture is older than the nation, in other words. So Kemetic culture is pre-dynastic. So the main point of this master key is that we should look in Africa for a long period of development, and we should not begin our analysis with the beginning of the nation of Kemet. We should look for what went before it.
Okay.
Okay, the New York Times had an interesting article, which was about the oldest nation in the world. And this is an example of what I was just talking about.
Back to the chart.
Here is Kemet, 3100 BC, beginning. But in the New York Times, they tell us there was another nation that is somewhere around 3500 BC.
Mm-hmm.
At least 200, maybe 300 or 400 years older than Kemet, there's this nation called Taseti. And this nation is further up south on the river in an area called Nubia. And that is called the oldest monarchy in the world. And, of course, they excavated the graves of these kings in Nubia. And these kings in Nubia were said to be tall, black-skinned people. The goddess Isis and her child were already in place at the beginning of Kemet.
Which was, you said,
Which was 3100 B.C.
Dynastic,
and then that's dynastic Kemet.
Uh-huh.
So dynastic Kemet begins after the religion that was the primary religion of Kemet had already been created.
Uh-huh.
So when you go to Taseti, for example, there is God Horus. This child that's being held by the Virgin Mother is already recorded in Taseti, south of Kemet, and it's much older than Kemet. So the religion is in place, astronomy is in place, writing, the hieroglyphics or Medu Netcher is in place. All of those things are already in place. So the culture is in place, before the political organization of Kemet as a nation.
Okay.
Osiris is the god who was associated with Isis, the husband of Isis, symbolically. You see Osiris here with the shepherd's crook and the flail, and he was then the supreme god who was married to Isis. So that becomes the god who is married to a virgin, and they have an offspring, and so we have the first holy family. And so that's an example of a religious story that is similar to the Christian story, but it's 3,000 years older than the Christian story.
And is there a resurrection element here also?
Osiris was resurrected. He was crucified by his brother, cut up into 14 or 28 pieces, depending on the story. His evil brother Set, jealous of him for several things, cut him up, and he was, again, he was risen from the dead to rule over the dead. And that was the story of Osiris.
This is the earliest story of the resurrection.
Again, that goes back about 3,000 years before Christ.
Okay. Master key number two.
Okay, the second concept that we need to keep in mind, Kemetic culture remained intact through the 7th century A.D. The culture, that's this cultural line that I showed you on the chart. And if we can go back to the chart here.
Okay, let's hold it a minute. Let's let our people get in place.
Okay. So here's the 3,000-year line. It stays the same, the way of life, this religion, this philosophy, up to this point right here. And it's at this point that we get a rather abrupt change in the culture of Kemet. The reason for it is that the conversion of Africans in Kemet to the religion of Islam. This is after the Prophet Muhammad. And then you get at this point a change in belief, but you also get a change in population at this point. You get large numbers of Arabic-speaking people, Arab people with Arabic culture, that come into the Nile Valley and join those that were already there and give to what is now Egypt, rather than Kemet, its essential character, which we see still present in Egypt today.
Okay, let's go on.
Okay, on the third master key, generally in Kemet, if you look at the data, the older things are, the better they are. In other words, the first cultures were more perfect than later cultures. So if I go to this time chart here, and I get back to Dynasty 1, come to Dynasty 3 when they started building pyramids, the earliest pyramids are the best pyramids, and they're still standing.
Okay, let's see if we have an example. Aren't
the last pyramid, here's an example of the early pyramid, the Step Pyramid. That's the first pyramid. That pyramid is still standing. It was not the most perfect pyramid. The most perfect pyramid would be the Great Pyramid. And the Great Pyramid is that one in the far part of the slide. And that is the Pyramid of Giza. But we see two other pyramids with it. Now, these are some of the best formed pyramids. These pyramids would be around 2500 B.C. After this, there were about another 75 or so pyramids, and they began to deteriorate in quality. So that's one example of older being better.
Well, we have this graphic up there, the pyramid. How tall is that?
That pyramid, the Great Pyramid, is about 43 stories tall.
Built when?
Built, the Great Pyramid was built around 2500 B.C.
Okay.
If we look again at older is better, if we look at the text, this is the text of the oldest Bible in the world, written on the walls of the tomb of Unas. And if you read what becomes from this and other tombs, a book called the Book of the Dead. Its formal name is the Per Imhru, or the Book of Coming Forth from Darkness into Light. Then you'll see that, for example, you see no pornography there. Mm-hmm. You see, in fact, you don't even see pictures there. You see pure text. And if you go back, the text was pure, not only in written form, but in symbolic form. It was better looking text. It looked better as it was carved into the walls and colored, and some of those colors are still there.
Okay.
And in addition to looking better, the ideas we're less contaminated with superstition and what have you.
Okay.
We see, for example, older is better here again in terms of the temple at Saqqara. This is the funerary temple at Saqqara of King Zoser that was done approximately 2700 B.C. And we see here also the antecedents of Greek architecture. If you see the columns here, these columns dating now from 2700 B.C., compared to the Parthenon on the Acropolis, which would not appear until around 500 B.C. So here we have something more than 2,000 years older than that building that we call the Parthenon in Greece, and it's already present in the architecture.
So when we see columns,
African columns. They're copies of African architecture.
Okay.
The fourth master key is that you always have to remember when looking at any information from Kemet that their orientation was up south.
Are you going to be using the map for this?
We can show you
okay,
on the map.
Let our folks get in place. Okay. Go ahead.
That the that this river starts.
Okay, we're going to come back, but I have a caller with his hand raised. I'm going to open it up, and then we come back. We're going into America. 202, you with me? Eric O 202. Okay.
I want you.
Come on, brother.
I was just listening to the program. I didn't have a question or comment at this point in time.
Okay. All right. Well, let's continue to ride.
All right.
Okay. Now, I just wanted to give you a brief synopsis. You know, if you're listening, guy, he's constantly saying these were black people, African people. Okay. He didn't mention nothing about nobody else. But anytime you are listening to certain programs, you will hear people talk for hours about Egypt, and not one single time mention the fact that these were African people, or they were black people. Why do you think that happened? That is quite amazing. Even though ancient Kemet is in Africa, it seems like everybody want to put themselves in your skin. In your place, in your position. And we sit back and we just let them do it and just ride along with them and go along with it. We can't do that, man. You got to stop doing it. You got to just say, hey, hold on a minute. What you say? And let me put some straightener on that there. Hold on. Let me get some facts out here. Go get your children, too, so they can hear this, too, so you can stop lying to them.
We should use the term Kemet rather than the term Egypt, because that is the name that the Kemetic people use to refer to themselves. The name Egypt.
Okay, there you have it. They say we hear somebody, we automatically know. Now, this is not something that we don't know. We know this stuff. Okay, I'm not picking on anybody. I just want to make sure that we get the facts and get the facts right, so that if we're going to talk about something, we can talk about it correctly. Okay, now let's share some more light on some stuff before we go in there, just for a moment, before we go down into what we got to do.
You told black people that white people were committing biological genocide against us, and that by the year 2000, whatever, there would be no more black people. You would get one reaction. But you're saying that we're being threatened with cultural and psychological extinction. How do you get African people to see the urgency of this situation?
I don't know, frankly, if you can. I think that we have to focus on young people. Young African people who have not been so conditioned with a way of thinking that supports European imperialism, European power, that they still have the ability to use their intuition, their spirituality, their Africanness to create, to think beyond the limitations that have been given to them in European academies. I think most of us as adults, as elders, have been so conditioned that we're afraid to move beyond the parameters that have been defined by our enemies in our thinking, so that our vision is limited. And so we are really not the people who should be conceptualizing the plans, you know, the movements, what we should be building. But I focus on the younger people who hopefully are still more in touch with what is natural to African people. And if I can affirm that in them, they will see the urgency. I find that in my teaching. I find that in teaching young people, that once they are affirmed and introduced in a conscious way to the African worldview, it becomes crystal clear to them, and they see in an urgency in us as African people building for self, as opposed to imitating forms which have been put in place to make sure that we continue to be oppressed.
Culturally and psychologically, do you think we realize what we have lost?
No, not. You know, it's ironic because we don't realize it on a conscious level, yet we live it every day. In the way we walk, in the way we talk, in the way in the music we create, there is a depth of spirituality which exists in us as a people, which has continued since our origins, that our ancestors have passed to us, and which we continue to pass on ourselves. That we don't consciously recognize as a strength. We don't realize that it is something that we need to use to think with, so that when we are presented with a European worldview in the classroom, we think that that's the only way to be. That's the only way to think. Because we didn't come with anything. So I don't think that we are aware on a conscious level of what it is that we've moved away from in terms of power. You see, that's what we're not aware of.
Could you talk some about how we came to be who and what we are today? You understand the question.
I think I do.
Okay.
I think that we have to look back at a period that I call the Ma'afa. We as Africans were very consciously stripped of our culture. Now, that becomes a platitude. You know, everybody's saying that. Stripped of our culture, but we have to see that we had a strong culture and so forth. But nobody seems to realize the depth of what that means. Being stripped of our culture meant being conditioned to accept ourselves as inferior beings. Okay? It meant that we were conditioned to feel that we had to be dependent on Europeans, dependent on white people, that we could not do things for ourselves and in our own image. That conditioning began with a period, a long period of terrorism, which was very physical, you know, physically manifested. At the same time, there was the breaking of the will. So there was cultural violence, I call it, you know, in the book, as well as the physical violence, which was very important. We then came to a period in which we mistakenly thought we were free. We're now at a point where we think that we have freedom, the ability to be whatever it is that we can be within this society and so forth. Yet what happens is that we are still thinking within a modality that has been determined by those who would oppress us, those who would control us. And we don't see beyond that. So the question for me becomes, who controls how you think? We have the ability to create our own structures, our own theories, our own definitions of reality, to look at the African worldview, to look at, for instance, the Dogon people, to look at the Kemetic people, to look at our own people who have, even look at Carter G. Woodson, for instance, the miseducation of the Negro, which I don't think was really ever understood by us, and to use these things as inspirations for the building of institutions, the creation of things, the building our own buildings. We have the ability to do that. So it's almost like we've been conditioned so well through such a long process that now it is us who are enslaving ourselves mentally.
Because the job has already been...
The job has been done. It would be so easy, in one sense, for us to undo it. That's what I'm saying in this book. Because the way the system of European control works is that you have to accept a concept of reality which makes them superior.
Okay, now, we are going to do a broadcast on the superiority of European people and lay the facts on the table so that you can determine whether or not they are superior based on the records that we will provide. We're coming to America now.
You said had come in and destroyed these African cities and populations and then started attacking the non-Africans in the Americas that we call Indians. And this friar came in, and he found some of the Africans who were here that your history book now calls Aztec. Now, you have to understand, they didn't call themselves Aztec no more than Ramses and those other Africans called themselves Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
Those are names that came on afterward. The term Aztec is actually derogatory. These were Moors. These were Islamic-believing brothers. These were Christian-believing brothers and sisters living in Mexico who had come over on those 2,500 ships that had come out of West Africa in 1306 and 1311. We have good records on those ships coming across the Atlantic. The failure was that the black historians didn't follow them to try to find out if there were records on this side that showed what happened to them after they left Senegambia that Dr. Ivan Van Sertima told us about, and Basil and others. Well, there is a good record here. They started recording their histories when they got here, saying, and we arrived in the ships. We landed south of Texas at a city called Panuco now. We came in to the Valley of Mexico and into the highland areas. We had wars. We made some alliances. We became powerful, and eventually we became the most powerful. These are the Mandinkas and the Fulani of West Africa who had come over. They were trying to find a place to settle. Now, this place had millions of people already here. It had been here since before the Africans had come over from Africa and from Europe as early as 22,000 and 23,000 years ago in ships. and had started building African cities all across the Americas. But here we are in 1306, 1311 A.D., and these African now Americans, these African Americans in 1306 and 1311 A.D. are now in Mexico in a land named for the African Meshi, M-E-C-I, and, of course, C-O means land of or region of or place of. This is Meshi's place, the African's place, Mexico. And they come into Meshi's land, would come in the B.C. period, and the place is full of people. But they're trying to carve themselves a place out of it, and with wars they do. But they notice that there is this island that no one is habitating. They're not building their cities or their towns on it. And these brothers and sisters know about ancient Memphis. They know about the West African city that was called Memphis, that was the capital of Egypt. 22,000 years before the time of Christ. They know about it, Memphis. They're looking for the ruins of Memphis. And they find it on this island. They knew Memphis was an island city. They knew it. Their own traditions had told of it. They were the people who had come over and populated Memphis. West Africa, not East Africa. West Africa, but then East Africa would come later, and South Africa and everywhere else was coming in. But they found the ruins on this island. Man-made island, one of the wonders of the ancient world that they say cannot be found now. The lake that was called Tashi in some literature and by other names. Nearby, the other ancient wonder of the world, Heliopolis, still stands, showing its pyramids and the famed labyrinth sitting right there, the place named for ancient Egypt's Tehuti. It's now called Teotihuacan, still carrying that ancient African name with the pyramids there and the labyrinth, the famed labyrinth still there, found by archaeologists. And they eventually said this city was one of the largest cities. No, they said it was the largest city on the planet up until the 8th century A.D. Largest city on the planet at 7 square miles. But they are not there. They're near. They're in Mexico, where Mexico City is now, built on top of those ancient African ruins. And now they found the ruins of ancient Memphis and rebuilt their city there, calling it after the old biblical name of Enoch. They call it, they pronounce it Tenochtitlan, but it's spelled T-E-N-O-C-H, Enoch, to Enochtitlan. So they own this old African city that dates to Genesis of the biblical, the African writings that we call biblical writings. And they're in this city that was Enoch's city and was also Memphis, and they build their city there. And that becomes the capital city that we start hearing is the Aztec capital city. Here are these Africans here. So when Spain comes in, they know exactly where they're going. They know what the history of this is. Their church has those books. They have the writings. You have to understand that once you understand that when the Africans had come into the Americas and built their cities that became known as ancient Egypt, then you're not going to only find Memphis. You're going to find that other capital city called this, sitting on the Yucatan Peninsula. You're going to find the African city called Troy sitting in Central America. You're going to find the ancient city called Thebes sitting in South America. That's why they call it Upper Egypt, and in the southland of the two lands called Tameri, North America and South America. So you have Thebes in the south as the capital. You have Memphis in the north. And once you understand that ancient Thebes is hidden under the eventual name of Jerusalem, because those ancient Africans had first built that city in honor of Heru, Amun's son, not Osiris' son, Amun's son, Heru. And they called it after Heru. And we flipped that H and J one time to give you from Heru to Jeru in the district of Salim. No, you're in Jerusalem, just the way some of the ancient writings still show that name.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Thebes, sitting in South America. And you have Memphis sitting where Mexico City is sitting now. Now, you have to understand now. Now, when you have your crusades, you are coming into the Americas. You already know Jerusalem is in South America because you've been here before. Egypt had been here. Europe had been here. Rome had been here. Persia had been here. Babylon had been here. Everybody knew about the Americas. When they came in with the Crusades, they went to capture the ancient African city in Jerusalem in South America. But every time they do it, now they had good success at first Crusade because they caught the brothers squabbling like they're still squabbling among each other over the different sects and different beliefs. And when they catch you divided like that, they just whoop all of you. So they came in and they were able to capture this ancient African great city sitting in South America called Jerusalem because they caught the brothers squabbling. Now, when they tried it again after they had been run out of the Americas, they came in again, and now they're trying to do it, and they find out the brothers have a strategy. Now they're working together. When they tried to besiege that fortress city of Jerusalem in South America in that high mountain, now the brothers from Mexico comes up behind them, these armies, and sandwiches them in, and now they get defeated, and they keep trying that, and they keep saying, you know what, we finally run out of luck on capturing Jerusalem. It wasn't that you're running out of luck. The brothers had started working together, and now there's a strategy. So when in the 1500s they say, you know what, I think what we need to do to be able to take these African cities and lands and all the riches and the drugs and the cocaine and everything else that's in the Americas to start making that money again, to get that land, I think we need to go and whoop the army in Memphis first, in Mexico first, so when we go down and attack Jerusalem this time, we won't get sandwiched in. So in this invasion in the 1500s, here the ships come, and they come into Mexico. And you'll see all the books, and they say the invasion and conquest of Mexico and Peru. But now something should have clicked in your brain right then. When you see Mexico, you don't see Peru right next door. Peru is not in Texas. It's hidden. It's hidden on the far side of South America, on the Pacific side. You can't even reach it coming through the Caribbean. Not in your ships. So here you go. How do you know where Peru is and you just found Mexico? They know. They know exactly where Jerusalem was. But they were going to knock out the armies at Mexico and then take the armies down to South America and then conquer Jerusalem. But now they have to hide this now, because if you are the church and you're saying you have a right to come in and conquer and destroy and mutilate and slaughter these people in the Americas and have the church's blessing out of Italy, the Rome there, you better have some kind of good justification if you're trying to say that you're humane. So they come in and they say, well, we're going to introduce them to the religion of Christianity. And so, you know, it's going to give them a benefit. So we can do these things because we eventually – the whole thing is we're going to save them. We're going to save the souls. And they certainly can't tell you that they came in and destroyed Jerusalem. But the Vatican had an interest, because when the church was developing in the Christian world, there were 12 churches. 11 of them are in the Americas, and one alone is there in Italy. But they wanted to be the head, and the 11 churches in the Americas would never allow it and would always vote as a block against it. Now, if you can wipe out the 11, you can become the head. So they had a vested interest in the destruction of the churches and the cities in the Americas. And Spain, of course, wanted the riches and the land. And so you knock out the armies at Mexico, you go down to Peru, and you knock out Jerusalem and wipe that city clean and rob it blind. But now you have to hide the histories so you won't be accused of destroying Jerusalem. And that's what was done. They knew that these were not Aztecs. Aztec means these people were worshiping the ancient religion of Sutec that some also believe is Set, ancient Set. And Set, if you go deeper, you'll find that this Set is also Cain in the ancient biblical writings called Genesis. Cain, that they spell as C-A-I-N, but in the other African records that we now call Egypt, he's called K-H-O-N, Khonsu, who slays his brother Osiris, who is the biblical Abel. That's why in the biblical writings, these African writings that they keep trying to give to somebody else and say that they're theirs, in these African writings, you find two worships going on, more than that, but two major ones. In South America, Amun has become the church of power. In Central America, where Heru was given the rule of Lower Egypt, it's Heru and Isis and Osiris, who was Abel, who is then called Baal and El. So you have El in Central America, you have Amun in South America, and when the Persians and the Babylonians came over and whooped the brothers in Central America, and those African cities fell, and some who survived and escaped that slavery went into South America and joined that group, they brought their books, combined them, and in those writings now we have two names for the ancient deity of Amun. We have Amun and Yah and Yahweh and all of the other names, and we also see him being called El because they were worshiping Osiris, El, as Baal, as Cain, as Khan in the north. That's not the same spirit. It's two different ancestral spirits that they're worshiping. Now, I know my Christian brothers and sisters probably don't want to hear that part of it. That when they say Amen at the end of the prayers, it's actually the man who founded Egypt, really founded it. It was existing some, but he really turned it into empire. Amun, 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 Amun. And so at the end of the prayers in the Old Testament, it's Amen. Christ, when this African came, when this brother came, this divine brother came with this knowledge that he had, and start saying, look, we've got a problem. I know it's going to get me killed to tell you, but I'm going to tell you that the worship you're worshiping is wrong. You do not have to kill your firstborn male children to please God. God never required it. The man who required it was Amun when he waged the war against Mexico, against Atlantis. Against Atlantis, against the Atlanteans at Memphis in Mexico. And he sent Horus's mother, Bast, to lead that charge. And the slaughter happened. And at the end of it, there was an agreement for sending him such bad tribute, such fat and bones instead of the meat, and such poor selection of crops as his tribute for saving you from the flood that had happened at Memphis that had devastated that land in Mexico. Then he says, okay, well, let me see what I can do to get this corrected. And when that war happened and that slaughter happened, they sued for peace. And the agreement was, okay, from now on, to make you remember to send me your best fruit, your first fruit, then this temple is going to be built. You're going to give your firstborn male offspring of stock and human. And so later with that same worship still going on 21,000, 22,000 years later, then now you, even before then, 1900 B.C., you have the Exodus, the Civil War of the Africans, and they're saying, look, we're taking South America away from the other Africans that were called Egypt, but look, this law here is too hard, giving up our first male born. And says, okay, well, it is kind of hard. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to let you redeem them. We're going to let you buy it back. And so here you go. Now you're able to give money, and if you're a farmer, your farm goods, or if you are a herder, you can bring your cattle and your others and redeem back your obligation of giving your firstborn male child. And so here's this requirement put on you. And when this African, this brother called Christ, came and said, look, that's enough of this. You're wrong. The church is not going to tell you you're wrong. But Ammon is not God. God is love. It's a spirit. It's not this man's spirit. And so you cannot worship both God and Ammon. And whoop, can't leave that in there. Put an M on the front of it and says you can't worship God and mammon, riches. No, you got to open your eyes so you can understand what happened. And so here's the history that's unfolding in the Americas. And then when these invasions happen in the 1500s A.D. and these ships come in and they whoop these African cities on the place that had been ancient Memphis, that had been Enoch's African city. All Genesis is African. All Deuteronomy is African. All Old Testament is African. These are African histories. It wasn't that Moses' wife was black. Moses is black. All of them are black. And you're sitting there trying to find who in the Old Testament is black. No. The problem now is who in the Old Testament was not. That's where we are. And some resist it. And that's okay. They'll catch up eventually. But Ammon is at the beginning. And Ammon names the land. He's loving it. It's a beautiful land. He's sitting there with his throne. He's left the Yucatan. He's whooped his father. He's now the king. He puts his throne away from the Yucatan into South America at the top of that mountain, that holy mountain where Jerusalem is eventually built. And he is even higher than that, up into the mountain peak north of that. That David eventually buys that land when he finds out that's where Ammon had his throne, and says, let's build a temple right here where Ammon was, because we are worshiping Ammon after all. And so they built that temple where Ammon had his throne. So your Ark of the Covenant, which is actually a boat, which is actually an ark, just like the Ark of Noah, it is still an ark when it becomes the Ark of the Covenant. It is a ship. And when you look at ancient Egypt, and you look on the walls, you see them carrying this ship as a little house, a little box on it, where Ammon likeness sits on the judgment seat. And the two cherubs, Isis and her sister Nephthys, their wings protect over the covering. There's your Ark of the Covenant that people say they cannot find. It's sitting and staring you right in your eyes. And when David bought that piece of land, he knew exactly what he was buying. He knew exactly where that temple was going to be built, and Solomon built it there. And they thought the temple was built in the city of Jerusalem. No, the African city of Jerusalem, sitting in that mountain, sits upriver from where Ammon's throne had been. That's why when you read in the African literature that we call the biblical narratives, it says that when Solomon built this city for Pharaoh's daughter and for his own palace and for the temple and the little temple for the ark, that they gathered all the leaders together and then took the ark up out of the city of David, up and out of the city of David. because he was going almost 50 miles downriver to the place where Armand Stone had been. These are things that we've not been told. I wanted to get what Rocks Cry out to you so we could begin the discussions and begin seeing where we went wrong, begin seeing the things that were hidden, throw those covers off. And I'm sorry, the black historians with their egos about Egypt being on the Nile, now they're stuck on the Nile, now they're scared to get on the Atlantic and come across to the Americans and find the rest of the Egypt. I'm sorry, eventually you'll get there. But we're there.
Mm-hmm.
And with the youth coming up, I want you to know that it's there. So you can now go forward. You won't get stuck in neutral. You can now go forward and find the rest of the African history and find that you were in the Americas 22,000 B.C. and building cities and having nation building and doing everything in the Americas from then up until now. So
indeed,
when Amun named that land the beautiful land, the word for beautiful Mary, M-A-R-E in some spellings, Mary. And the land
Mary
means Ta, T-A, Ta, the land of. Beautiful land, Ta Mary. And Ta Mary is still applied to the land. And just as the ancient Africans said, there is a north land and a south land. Now we have north Ta Mary and south Ta Mary. We simply move the Ta to the end of the word and called it America. South America, North America, you're living in the land that was named by Egypt. Here are your Moors who are named from Ta Mary, from the M and the R. You get your Moor. So even in the ancient African literature called biblical, you find Amorites, Amorites who lived on the north side of the Amazon River and went all the way up through Venezuela, what is now called Colombia, Guyana, all of that. Now we're going to get you a little deeper, something I haven't told before, because that land is also called Syria. Here is your Asia. So when you hear brothers...
Okay, I think that's in my opinion, I think that that little bit of information now, in my opinion, I think is the equivalent of a hydrogen bomb dropped on North America. But before we go get on the boat, we're gonna ride back over to the continent of Africa because I want to get the whole thing laid out so there'll be no more misunderstanding and no more need for nobody else to believe nothing else that ain't right. We're going to the phone line. Area code 402, you with me?
Yes, sir. Islam, Brother Tarka.
Islamo, what's going on?
That show right there, I want to thank you because that was the first show, my first probably and last telecast I was on. He gave that information up on, let me see. That was February 24th, 2012, and the name of the show was, if I'm not mistaken, Who Are the Real Ancestors of Jesus Christ?
Okay. Well, now, I got a real bombshell here on Jesus, what they call it, Jesus. I doubt if I get to it this evening, but then again, maybe I will be able to. However, what I'm trying to do is trying to get the so-called black record straight. And I know this is the government of the United States been meaning to tell us this. They just haven't gotten around to it yet. And I know in Harvard and Yale and Cambridge and all of them, they're going to get to it. They've been, you know, getting ready to get to it. So I'm just helping them along a little bit so they go ahead and let it on out and give it on, set it on straight.
Yeah,
they
know it. You know, mm-hmm. I was, me and my brother got a book back in the 70s called Ancient Egypt, The Light of the World by Gerald Massey.
Oh, yeah.
He was just, and what Brother Butler was saying,
Yeah.
He confirmed it. You know, I know it's true. But it was one thing, you know, I'm up in Omaha, Nebraska. And in that book, he mentions the Omaha tribe. There ain't but one Omaha tribe, and that's right here in Nebraska. Well, I call it Nebraska. I took the S out of it because that's the real name of the territory here. And he said they called them the wind people. And this was out of ancient Egypt. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, I've ran into a brother down here. This guy was a homeless guy, and he had a whole tote bag full of tattered papers. But within the papers that this guy had was some of the most extraordinary information that's been covered up that I've ever seen. And I told him, I said, man, I sure would like to get a hold of that. But, I don't think I duplicated it come out right. But I read over some of what I could read. Man, it was amazing. They have had contests, and Europeans had come up about history and stuff, and they had come up and laid the record out in it. And the professors told them to put that away. We're not going to give you an award for this. We just want this put away. Put it in a book, hide it under your bed, bury it, burn it, or whatever you have to do. But don't you come up in here telling that. Get away from us with that. But anyway, I'm going to go get in the boat now. We're going back across the Atlantic. We're coming back over here, but we're going across the Atlantic. And before we go, I need to bring something else by another sister. So hold on a minute.
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay. I hope the audio is right on this. If not, then we're going to get on in the boat and ride.
So it's almost like we've been conditioned so well through such a long process that now it is us who are enslaving ourselves mentally.
Because the job has already been...
The job has been done. It would be so easy, in one sense, for us to undo it. That's what I'm saying in this book. Because the way the system of European control works is that you have to accept a concept of reality which makes them superior. If you deny that, their thing will not work, and they will lose their control. So that they put all of this energy into establishing the system, which begins when you're 3, 4, and so forth, which defines reality in such a way where there's no spirit, because they aren't a spiritual people, you see, which talks about this objective truth and so forth, which says that African spirituality represents backwardness, so you need to move away from it. It does all of these things which make you as an African person, me as an African person, us, distrust the very part of ourselves, which is our strength.
I'm going to get back to this question, and that is this whole question of do we know what we have lost? Do we realize that we have not always been Democrats, have not always been Baptists, have not always been Black Greeks, have not always been Lynx, have not always... how do we conceive of ourselves in a different time?
I think that there is a lot that is being done within the movement of African-centered education in that regard. In terms of, I think we have more information now that we've ever had before. And I have seen the effect of that information. That is very important, that people do begin to realize and understand, first of all, how young Europe is in relationship to Africa and what we were putting into place, creating, building, conceiving of long before Europe existed. When you open people's minds to that, it can have a lot of power. Mm-hmm. So that I think that generally we have not understood that. But we have an opportunity to do so because of the work of many people now that is building on work that was done before that we didn't know about.
Other cultures have exhibited aggression, imperialistic tendencies. What accounts for Europe's success?
I'm glad you got to that question. Because what it allows me to do, I think, is to get at what I think is the specialness of the approach, the method that I used in this study. So it's going to take me a little while, if that's okay. I said to myself that, and this definitely was with the help of the ancestors, I want to, you know, affirm that, by the way, that it was not...
Why is that important?
That's important because of our concept of connectedness, our concept of the universe, that it's not just words to talk of a spiritual universe and our spirituality as a people, but we've got to understand where our energy comes from. And I know that that's where mine came from. So this is ours. This belongs to us. I had to say, how would I approach studying the European given African conception? You see, it's one thing to say, okay, I want to do this, but then use their conception. What does it mean for us to really think in African terms? And so what I did was to develop concepts that came from an African worldview, not a European worldview. And I came up with the concept of Asili. I also used African language. That's a Kiswahili word that means seed, origin, the essence of something. The reason that was important was because what people would say is, and they will say, oh, Europe is so vast. It is, there are so many different kinds of European forms and different countries. How can you talk about Europe as a whole? Now, of course, they've been talking about Europe as a whole all of this time, but when we begin to look at them, suddenly it's going to be, no, you can't really do this because it's too diverse. I needed a concept which could explain a culture in terms of its core, in terms of its ideological core, so that you could look at every different aspect of the culture and see how it fits into this one seed or core. And that's why I used the Asili. And the idea of the seed was that once that Asili is in place, that cultural Asili, that it will seek to fulfill itself. So the way in which the culture will develop will all be feeding into that Asili. And that would help me to get at consistency in terms of European development. What throws us as a people is that we make exceptions. You know, we say, oh, well, that's different over here, and that's different. This is a good one over here, and this doesn't really work that way. But in my analysis, it's all consistent, and it's all working for one purpose. And the concept of Asili helps me to see that. And that is, that comes to the answer to your question, is that what I was able to do was to see that the nature of the European Asili was to seek power. That it, in essence, is, we could almost say it is an Asili which lacks wholeness and therefore must always see. Go back to Yorugu now. Remember Yorugu as the incomplete being that is always must be seeking but can never be fulfilled because he can't get the complementary part of himself. Their Asili, the European cultural Asili, is incomplete, must always be seeking. Now, it cannot be fulfilled through spirit because they have no knowledge of spirit, no relationship to spiritual reality. Therefore, fulfillment is sought through power. And power here means power over others. And what that means is that everything within the culture, all of the development of European culture, all of the forms, all of the institutions, the ideas even, are all for the purpose of achieving European power. Now, your question was, if we can recognize that there have been imperialistic behaviors in other cultures, then what is the difference between European culture and these other cultures? And the answer is that Europeans have been most successful at achieving world domination because everything within the culture supports the quest for domination.
Everything.
Everything. Including, and most importantly to me, their philosophical concepts, including their concept of truth, including their academies, academia, the intellectuals, including that. It works with, including Christianity as it manifests itself, within the European development. All of that works for the achievement of European power.
Okay. I just thought I'd drop off that part, and now we're ready to go on back over here again and deal with the deal with a little bit more of this stuff here in Africa.
And therefore became very important.
So this is the mother of?
That's the mother of Pharaoh Akhenaten, and some people also say the mother of King Tut, and the mother-in-law of Nefertiti.
Okay.
Again, these are Waset families. These are up-south families. Here's another up-south priestess, Anutawi, who is a priestess of ancient Kemet, but again, she's up-south. So if you notice that the center of power at this time is in the middle of the country or in the part of the country least infiltrated by outside influences, less mixed racially, less mixed culturally. And that would be examples of what we've been talking about.
People are so used to seeing white Egyptians.
Right.
One must ask, where do these people come from?
Right. Well, see, those people have been there all the time. They're just not in the books.
Uh-huh.
The books that show pictures of white Egyptians normally show pictures of the Egyptians, not the Kemites, and that means they're showing pictures of people who were ruling or who were in Egypt during the Greek and Roman times and after that. And so it's always important to date the picture and to know whether you're talking about royalty or not.
Okay.
This, virtually all creativities are indigenous, and the invasions are destructive. The Greco-Romans were imitated. So if I go back to the chart here, and let's take a look. Golden Age number one, Golden Age number two, invasion. This is the first invasion. This was a destructive invasion from Asia. They are not given the credit with building temples, with building pyramids, with building religion. They were very destructive. And then there is a return in Dynasty 18 and 19, which is the third Golden Age, and the Greco-Romans don't actually get to Kemet and begin to impose their name, Greece, and their culture and their political control until here. You see, the Greeks come in 332 B.C., which is after all four Golden Ages, but they didn't destroy. They are the exception to the invasion being destructive. What they did was imitate. Now, the Romans that come in after the Greeks, beginning about 30 years before Christ, they're the ones that began to destroy again. And particularly, they destroyed the educational and religious institutions to the extent that they were able to do that over the course of 200 to 300 years.
Now, at that 332 B.C., is that basically when you see the white?
Right. This is when you'll see large numbers of white. Well, you also see it here with the Persians in 525 B.C. But then you're talking about large numbers of settlers here with the Greeks. Alexander the Great And then the Caesars here with the Romans, and you had large numbers of people infiltrating into Alexandria and around Cairo. Generally, they didn't go very far up south, but nevertheless, some did. And it's not until you get the Arabic population that you begin to get that large infusion of foreigners up south. Okay, this is part of the literature during the period of the... in fact, this dates all the way back to the beginning of Comitic times.
But that this was in place.
This would be in place, and it's part of the culture all the way through, and it's an example of what people destroyed. You know, they, the invaders were destructive rather than creative. They didn't create this religion. It was already in place.
And the Egyptian Book of the Dead deals with what?
The Egyptian Book of the Dead is really much like the first five books of Moses or the Pentateuch in the Old Testament. It deals with the creation. It deals with, some people say they're spells, you know, but you have to really get into the study of Kemetic religion to understand that these things are part of a very a deep symbolic studies that you don't just talk about. You have to go through a training process in order to understand them.
Okay.
Know? This is an example of the Immaculate Conception of with the god Horus, god Osiris lying down on his back, and you'll see the goddess Isis who is hovering above him with his erect penis, and that is the actual Immaculate Conception in stone, and this is at the Temple of Abydos, and that's a story, of course, that we'll pick up in Christianity, and that was already created by Africans long before it appeared in anybody else's religion. Here is an example of the imitation. You know, all of these are examples of imitation. The Book of the Dead was imitated in the religious literature of other people. The creation story was imitated. Here's the imitation with a god giving life to now a Greek pharaoh. This Greek pharaoh, this is outside the temple of Horus at Edfu, which is a reconstructed temple under the authority of the Greeks with their money. When they took over, they followed the desires of the priests, and they began to reconstruct. That's imitation. This is after Alexander the Great. And this is Alexander the Great here, or at least one of the statues of Alexander the Great. And you can see how different this is.
Who goes into Egypt?
He goes into Egypt and is, in fact, welcomed by the Kemetic people of the time as the deliverer from the Persians. They were happy to see him come. And generally speaking, you could say the Greeks were fairly respectful of the Kemetic people. But they were basically imitators of the Kemetic people.
So when the Greeks went in there, the Africans were already out of control.
Yes, they had already lost control to the Persians. Mm-hmm. And they never regained control again after that.
Okay, master key number eight.
Master key number eight is that if you want to understand the thinking of Kemet, you must think in terms of symbolic thought and metaphorical thought. If you take things literally, you'll be mistaken. So that if you think that just because you see a god that has a man's body and an animal's head, for example, that this is animal worship, you will be missing the entire point because there's much more to it than that. And so here we have examples of the use of things like, well, look at Keperra there, for example, the beetle. You know, that is this, that is, comes from a study of biology. So they noticed that this beetle, the dung beetle, a particular beetle, would bury its eggs and then bury them in the sand, and then as the sun came out, it would heat, and then all of a sudden these eggs would break open, and so they associated that with birth and creativity and creation. And so the Keperra then becomes the god who is coming forth. So you show the beetle, but you don't mean beetle, so you're not worshiping a beetle. Mm-hmm. You're using the beetle as the symbol of the idea of creation.
Okay.
This is another example. Here's a man with a dog's head. You're not worshiping the animal, the dog, but that dog, the jackal, according to Swalla de Lubitz and others who studied this, is the symbol of he is used as a symbol associated with the preparation of the dead, in this case, embalming. His name is Anpu. or some people, the Greeks called him Anubis. That dog is the symbol, is used as a symbol because he can dig up dead meat and eat it before it putrefies and is of no value, so that he makes fine distinctions. He can discriminate between what is life-giving and which is life-taking. And so they say, well, why not use him as a symbol for judgment, for making fine judgment? So you see him here, but you will also see him at handling the scales of justice, where the heart of the deceased is weighed against the feather of truth. Mm-hmm. So that is a symbolic thought, not to be taken literally. But most people who try to study Kemetic religion tend to try to take it literally, and they will make a mistake every time.
So aren't Christians sometimes referred to as the sheep and the
Sheep and the shepherd, right? Uh-huh. In Christianity,
uh-huh.
And you don't expect that people are actually calling people animals,
right?
But they are manifesting sheep-like qualities, you know. And the shepherd is acting in relationship to people the way the shepherd acts in relationship to sheep.
Okay.
The last, not the last, but the ninth master key. Science generated religion, philosophy, and general culture. In other words, it's really important in looking at ancient Kemet to know that the basis of the culture was totally scientific. In other words, painful observations, tireless observations over literally thousands of years produce insights into how nature works. And it's nature's pattern that reflects a divine will, according.
Okay, we'll be back, but let's get back in the boat, and now we're finna go back to America. Okay, we just want to go over there and drop that bombshell there. We're coming back to America as we continue to cut on the faucet and let the truth run.
Here and goes this way, which means it flows from south to north, so it's going.
All right, let's go back.
Home of the explorer, if you know what I mean. And so, you know, I found out about that one, and I went up, and I was looking for the Kali still. I'm looking for the Kali, the blacks. And she gave me a list of books to look for. When Rocks Cry Out goes into the story, it lets you know what that conversation was about, the secrecy of it. And then I went looking for the books, and my time was running out, but I went to the section where the books should have been. They were checked out or gone, and I grabbed the one book that was still left there, and it was the five letters that Hernando Cortez had written back to Spain. Now, Hernando Cortez is this Spaniard who came over and was at Cuba and decided he was going to jump the gun and come in and invade the Americas, going to invade the Aztecs. And so he was the one that led the invasion of the black nation that was there that we now call Aztec. But he was writing what he saw. These were not really letters. They were narratives of what he saw and what was going on and what they were doing as well. But he was writing about the mosque that he saw. He was writing about the barbershops that he saw, how fine these barbers were. And he was talking about the Moorish dress that they wore. The clothing was Moorish, and the buildings were Moorish in architecture. And when he crossed on the top of the mountain to invade the land, to come down to this capital of the Aztecs, he was at the top of the mountain, and he looked down, and he made this strange remark. He says, "And there lies far-flung Venus." That doesn't mean very much to many people, but it meant a lot to me. I was familiar with Venus over on that side of the ocean and that city sitting on that water, and I knew what he was saying. Here was a city built on canals with ships all around it, And it's this African city there with the Moorish architecture built on the design of a Venus. And later I understood that's exactly what it was. He started describing the city. Here's this marvelous African city sitting on a man-made island in a man-made sea where Mexico City stands right now. And you've got this black man. If you've ever seen this piece of art called the Moorish Chief, I'm going to tell you right now, they said they don't know who that man is modeled after. But when you understand the descriptions of Montezuma, this African that they call Montezuma, you will see that Moorish chief and you will be looking exactly at Montezuma. He is fitting every description that they gave, and then he has this little secret thing about it. When you look on his head, you see he's got this white cowl on his head, and underneath that white cowl is a little small red cap. Now, they'll try to say that's about the assassins or the assassins. No, you got to understand, Mexico is Lower Egypt. That's where Memphis was, and when you're the king of Memphis, your crown is red. And they're trying to show him secretly that this is Montezuma. They said Montezuma is this medium-built man, and they talked about the beard that he has that's shaped, and they're talking about he's black, and then others said very dark-complected. And I'm looking at the Moorish chief, and I'm not seeing anything that does not agree with the descriptions that they give of Montezuma. And I'm saying, well, now we got a problem. We, you know, Aztecs are Indians. That's what I was told. But now I've got Martha Malaku's education under my belt. And in the book of Ivan Van Sertima, he talks about those two expeditions, those two voyages of ships that came out of Senegambia. He's talking about those 500 ships and those 2,000 ships that went across in 1306 and again in 1311 looking for the first group of ships or about those years. Now, we have those ships coming across the Atlantic from West Africa, and then they say there is no record of what happened to them, except now I'm in the Americas. I'm at Mexico. I'm looking in the records that the friars put together when they talk to these Africans there whose histories were being destroyed as soon as they took over that land. They were just burning them in the street, piling up the books. And yet, here is this friar, here's this Bernardino Sahagún who's come in and he's earned that trust. And they said, well, we got a couple of books they didn't get. And so he's recreating the histories that Spain and the church thought they had destroyed. And so he's rewriting them all over again. And he's showing these Aztecs as blacks with African features. And now it gets a little better because he's also talking about the conversation that Montezuma had with Cortez. And now here is Cortez also putting in his journal the conversation he had with Montezuma. And here is Castillo. He's putting in the conversation that Cortez had with Montezuma, and here are these other writers, and they're putting in this conversation that Montezuma is having with Cortez. And I thought it was unbelievable that Montezuma is sitting right there, this black African in this Moorish clothing with this little red cap on, because he's really the king of Memphis. And he's sitting there and he says, well, you know, my father and my grandfathers say that we are not of this land. He said very clearly to Cortez, we are strangers here. We come across that sea in ships, and we landed at the city of Panuco, right south of Texas, and we came in, and people really didn't want to have much to do with us, but we found out how to work politics, and we started making some alliances, and before they knew it, we had become the most powerful group, and now we are the powerful group. And then we came and we found this island and built our capital on it in 1325 A.D. Now, we have 500 ships and then 2,000 ships leaving out of West Africa in 1306, 1311. They're crossing the Atlantic. Nobody knows what happened to them. And here the Aztecs are saying, and we arrived about that same time in our ships.
coming from over there where the sunrise, and we came in, and now they're being painted in their books as blacks, as Africans. And so the white scholars who then got control started explaining things, and they started saying things like, well, you know, when they came in, they started looking for the symbol of a cactus with an eagle standing on the cactus clutching a serpent in his claw. That's, I wish I could tell you what that really was, but that's not the truth. These Africans already knew that other Africans had built cities in the Americas. That's why they were coming over here. And now they were looking for that other West African nation called Memphis. And the symbol of Memphis was because Upper Egypt, the eagle, had defeated the Lower Egypt, which was the symbol of the serpent, and Dan was the serpent, like the Dan people in West Africa. And so the symbol of the United Kingdom was this serpent being held in the claw of this eagle. And they knew at Memphis that symbol would be there. And when they found that island with those columns broke down and with these symbols of Egypt on it, they knew where they were. And they started rebuilding Memphis, the capital city that they now call Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital, actually is an African capital built on the top of ancient Memphis, the other West African capital that was built there in Mexico. So here we go. So now we have the understanding that Martha Malakou had given me from Ivan Van Sertima's book about these ships coming over. Now we've got Hernan Cortez's letters talking about the conversation with Montezuma saying, and we arrived in these ships, not across the Pacific from the Orient, as so many professors try to tell you now. He said, we came across that one, where the sun rises. We came from that direction and came over. Well, Asia's not over there. Africa is over there. So now we have these Africans coming in. Now, here's the deal. Hernando Cortez stops by the Yucatan Peninsula before he comes in, and he picks up a woman to help translate so he can know the secret language and know what they're going to do, and she's going to interpret it for him. Poor sister tore up the American African nations with what she did, but she did it for a reason. They had expelled her from this city some years before, took her from grace, disgraced her, and now she wanted revenge. And so they recruited her, and she came in, and she was telling them everything they were saying secretly that they thought Cortez and these Spaniards could not understand. But they kept calling this woman Marina. But really, they were also calling her Malinche. And it wasn't until I got another piece of understanding that was coming out of West Africa that says, when you talk about Mandinka, the Fulani called them Malinche. They were calling this woman Mandinka the entire time. Malinche. Malinche, what they say. Malinche, do this. She's a Mandinka. She has come from Mexico City, where these other Africans were building their capital city on that island. So now we have Fulani in the area. We have Mandinka in the area. We have the book showing them as blacks and with African features. We have Montezuma saying, we arrived in ships coming from across the Atlantic, and we came in the 1300s and built this capital in 1325, just a few years after those ships left out of West Africa. Oh, we have Africans now. And then it got very, very nice when I found these forbidden histories that they wrote, that the Bernardino Sahagún put back together, that they had destroyed. And then they confiscated these records and kept them in a monastery for about 300 years, hid them, and finally they came back out. But he had recreated the histories of the Americas. And here this friar was writing what these Africans were telling him about the history. And they said, well, you have to understand that even the old mix, when they came over, you know, they came with this pharaoh, and they call him Naharka, but we know Taharka's name when we hear it, even if they change the T to an N. It's Naharka, it's Taharka. And he's dead, and he's coming to be buried in this area. But they said that the man that's leading this expedition is the African whose name is Meci, M-E-C-I. And now we have the meaning of Mexico. because they were first called after this African, the land of Meshi, and the land of is, of course, Ko and Ka and Ta and those kinds of terms. And so Meshi-Ko, Meshi's land became Meshi-Ko, and now we say Mexico. It's named after that African, Meshi. And there it was in the records that this friar, Bernardino Sahagún, had assembled. That's why they were called the Forbidden Histories. Blacks were never to know these again. So now we're in Mexico. We have that part. But then the Aztecs say, but all these pyramids there in the nearby great city, right here beside us, we don't know who built those, and I want to know who they were. Well, I've got the West Africans in, but now we've got some pyramids that's looking a lot like Egypt. So I went and asked Egypt. I started checking their records to ask them, do y'all know anything about the Americas? Have you written anything? I mean, if you build a city like Heliopolis in the Americas, I figure you're going to write about it. And they did. And I saw so much in those records. One of the first things I saw were the writings that said, you know what, and we would go to this pyramid, and we would ascend the double staircase and receive our crown as Pharaoh. Well, the Great Pyramid on the Nile in Northeast Africa doesn't have stair steps going up it. It doesn't have temples on top of its summits. They could not go and break through the vault on the temples atop those great pyramids. There are none there. And that was the clue that Egypt was writing about the Americas. And the deeper I got into the records, the clearer it got. They started actually saying, and because Amun loved that land so much, he said it's his beloved land, and that word was Meri, the beloved, Meri, M-E-R-I, Meri. And the land, of course, as before, is Ta. So you have the land, the beloved land, Ta Meri. And they kept that name and just put the Ta on the end of it. So Ta Meri became a Meri Ta. We simply say America. We kept the name that Egypt gave to the Americas. So that was the big mystery behind that $10 million map that Martin Waldseemüller made and then put the name America on it in 1507. And then those who knew and those who were trying to hide things said, wait a minute. You can't put that name on here. And the next time you reprinted that map, it was off. It was gone. Because that's the name that Egypt had given the land, Ta Meri. That's where America came from. So now I have Egypt writing about the Americas, but they go further. They don't just talk about we named the Americas. They said where it was. They said our founders, Amun them, Osiris, Isis, all of these. Of course, they used those other names, you know, the Asa and the Aset. And so they said they are in the west. And all over the monuments, they talked about Osiris and said he is foremost of the westerners, which means not in the front of. He was the most worshipped throughout in the west. And not just his dead spirit, they were talking about the man himself being in the west. So now I have those records. And the deeper I got, the clearer it became. And then I started locating the cities all through the Americas, and not North America. Egypt says, man, those, they didn't call them Indians, but they said their cavalry is just so strong. They have bow and arrow cavalry. They are on horseback, and they are so strong, it's just devastating to us to try to take that land. So I tell you what, we're going to cut it right off at that river, and that's why all these pyramids are showing up from Mexico going down south, because those Apaches and Comanches and whatever other tribes were there, black tribes and others, were whooping Egypt something fierce. They did leave the record, though, that Osiris got as far as Washington, D.C., he said, I got to this land, and in this land in the north, I got to the place of the river with the largest, widest mouth. And I immediately ran to the Mississippi. I started looking around trying to see, well, where is he? I'm trying to see where Osiris is. I see that city called Baton Rouge. I know that's talking about, it's got Aten's name in it, A-T-O-N, Baton Rouge. I know that's red. And I'm looking at it. It kind of sounds like it might be an Egypt connection. I'm looking for it, but that was wrong. They said, no, when you get to that place, that's Patiline. That's an island. That's a large island. Man, there ain't no island here called no Patiline. And then understanding comes in. It says, wait a minute, look at the map again. See where the Mississippi River splits and one goes over toward New Orleans and the other one goes down toward Alexandria. I said, well, yeah. I said, well, you know, when you have a Mississippi River that splits in two, then the land between those two rivers is an island because on the south side of it is the Gulf of Mexico. All that land is an island. I was like, oh, man, here's Patiline. But he says, but that's not where I went to. He said, that's not the river I'm talking about. He said, this one has a huge mouth. And then I looked further up, and there it was. There's the Potomac and all of those waterways coming together, the Chesapeake, and making this huge mouth to this river before it empties into the Atlantic. And they say, when you get to that place, there's going to be a city designed, laid out in the shape of a parallelogram, which is like a rectangle, square. And dadgummit, if they didn't lay out Washington, D.C. in the exact same configuration that ancient Egypt said that city would be in. And then they stuck an obelisk there. Egypt wrote about that. They just said it was too hard to keep control of that land with that very strong horseback army of bow and arrow shooting warriors. So then we go down toward the south. It's okay, we have the northern extent, let's go south. And we went through Central America, and I saw the cities there. And it will surprise you to know that Egypt actually built this city that we call Troy. Troy is in Central America. If you don't know the history of it before they start calling it Troy, you will never find it probably. But when Egypt wrote about it, they actually called it with those same letters. One word was T-R-W, Troy. But they said, well, we have another name for that city. We call it Kuban, K-U-B-B-A-N. It means the hidden city because Troy is way up from the water at a time where cities, major cities, were being placed on the waterway because that's how commerce was being conducted by ship. Troy was not. Troy was up in the rainforest, way up in the mountains, hidden. And so Egypt called it Kuban, the hidden city. And I'm going to give you something I've never told anybody other than close associates. You want to find Troy? You go find the city that Egypt says its name is Kuban. And you'll find this Maya city called C-O-P-A-N, Copan. And there you will have ancient Troy. That's the African city. So you go further south. You go through Central America. Then you go into South America. I'm looking for Thebes now. I've got Memphis. But they said Thebes is Thebes of the West. That's how they wrote it. Thebes of the West. I want to know where it is. And I found it. And the great thing about it is Thebes of the West is the city that David took. That's Jerusalem. It was built to honor the ancient Egyptian ruler, co-founder, the one that most of your listeners will probably recognize as Heru, that others call Horus. The city was built to honor him, and it was laid out in the shape of the hieroglyphic symbol that is his name. When you look in the ancient hieroglyphs that these Africans that we now call Egyptians left, when they wrote the word, the name Heru, it's the hawk in profile, the entire body with the wings on the side, that gives you the word H-E-R-U, or Heru. And they laid out the city in that design. It's still there right now today. When you fly above and look down, there is that hawk laid out on the ground, the walls, the streets, the temples, everything that they had laid that they have knocked down, but the foundations are still there. It shows you the outline of the name of the city. It was ancient Egypt's or ancient Africa's. They built a temple there to honor Heru. And some of the listeners and readers will know that one of the words that ancient Egypt used for temple was Per. like a rectangle with an opening in it, almost like a house or a temple. And it was Per, P-R, or P-E-R. And so when they have that temple there and they're talking about that place where this famous temple of Heru is, they would say the temple of Heru or Per-Heru. And so now we don't say Per-Heru, we simply say Peru. It's that simple. It's that clear. It's been standing in front of our eyes this entire time. But as long as you let others educate you and tell you what a thing means and you don't test it, you keep teaching the same errors. And that's what was going on. They were getting some knowledge, but they were teaching the errors with the knowledge that they were getting. The Egyptologists knew, but they knew that they were going to hide those Africans. They were going to hide that this was an African civilization because they were trying to justify blacks as being inhuman so that they could make wealth off of them as slaves. And you couldn't say that they were inhuman and uncultivated if you show them with these civilizations. So they distanced them. They divorced the African from the Egyptian histories, or they attempted to. When they came into the Americas in the 1500s, supposedly stumbling upon it with Columbus, you have to understand Columbus had just returned from West Africa. He had the maps. The same ones that had come over and became what we now call Aztecs, and they hated that. That was a derogatory term. It meant that they worshipped the pagan deity Sutek that ancient Egypt writes about. So if you're of something, you are a something, you are of it. So they were a Sutecs or Aztecs. They said, no, we're Christians, we're Muslims, and there are others among us who do worship the traditional beliefs. But they were in a mode of trying to show them as being uncultured and uncivilized. So they knew when they came in the 1500s, they knew where they were. They knew this was Egypt. You find this strange letter in Spain where they are having the wars against the blacks who are now running Spain, and they didn't lose that until 1492. And when they defeated those Moors, then they said, now we can go and fight the war against the blacks over in the Americas, but not until we whoop the ones that's on our doorstep or we're on their doorstep. So that's the history that's unfolding. They knew that the Holy Lands were over here. The Vatican knew. And they sent it over to destroy these churches and these people so that the Vatican could be the head of the churches by destroying the other 11 that was in the Americas. And Spain had the right to come in and start trying to get the commerce to become rich off of the gold and the other things in the African cities. And pyramid on the Nile in Northeast Africa doesn't have stair steps going up it. It doesn't have temples on top of its summits. They could not go and break through the boat on the temples atop those great pyramids. There are none there. And that was the clue that Egypt was writing about the Americas. And the deeper I got into the records, the clearer it got. They started actually saying, and because Amun loved that land so much, he said it's his beloved land, and that word was Mary, the beloved, Mary, M-E-R-I, Mary. And the land, of course, as before, is Ta. So you have the land, the beloved land, Mary. And they kept that name and just put the Ta on the end of it. So Ta Mary became a Mary Ta. We simply say America. We kept the name that Egypt gave to the Americas. So that was the big mystery behind that $10 million map that Martin Waldseemüller made and then put the name America on it in 1507. And then those who knew and those who were trying to hide things said, wait a minute, you can't put that name on here. And the next time he reprinted that map, it was off. It was gone. because that's the name that Egypt had given the land, Tamari. That's where America came from. So now I have Egypt writing about the Americas, but they go further. They don't just talk about we named the Americas. They say it where it was. They say our founders, Amenemhat, Osiris, Isis, all of these, of course, they use those other names, you know, the Asa and the Aset. And so they said they are in the West. And all over the monuments, they talked about Osiris and said he is foremost of the Westerners, which means not in the front of. He was the most worshipped throughout in the West. And not just his dead spirit, they were talking about the man himself being in the West. So now I have those records. And the deeper I got, the clearer it became. And then I started locating the cities all through the Americas, and not North America. Egypt says, man, those, they didn't call them Indians, but they said their cavalry is just so strong. They have bow and arrow cavalry. They are on horseback, and they are so strong, it's just devastating to us to try to take that land. So I tell you what, we're going to cut it right off at that river, and that's why all these pyramids are showing up from Mexico going down south, because those Apaches and Comanches and whatever other tribes were there, black tribes and others, were whooping Egypt something fierce. They did leave the record, though, that Osiris got as far as Washington, D.C. He said, I got to this land. And in this land in the north, I got to the place of the river with the largest, widest mouth. And I immediately ran to the Mississippi. I started looking around trying to see, well, where is he? I'm trying to see where Osiris is. I see that city called Baton Rouge. I know that's talking about, it's got Aton's name in it, A-T-O-N, Baton Rouge. I know that's red. And I'm looking at it. It kind of sounds like it might be an Egypt connection. I'm looking for it, but that was wrong. They said, no, when you get to that place, that's Pateline. That's an island. That's a large island. I said, man, there ain't no island here called no Pateline. And then understanding comes in. I said, wait a minute, look at the map again. See where the Mississippi River splits, and one goes over toward New Orleans and the other one goes down toward Alexandria. I said, well, yeah. So, well, you know, when you have a Mississippi River that splits in two, then the land between those two rivers is an island, because on the south side of it is the Gulf of Mexico. All that land is an island. I was like, oh, man, here is Pateline. But he says, but that's not where I went to. He said, that's not the river I'm talking about. He said, this one has a huge mouth. And then I looked further up, and there it was. There's the Potomac and all of those waterways coming together, the Chesapeake, and making this huge mouth to this river before it empties into the Atlantic. And they say, when you get to that place, there's going to be a city designed, laid out in the shape of a parallelogram, which is like a rectangle, square. And that government, if they didn't lay out Washington, D.C. in the exact same configuration that ancient Egypt said that city would be in. And then they stuck an obelisk there. Egypt wrote about that. They just said it was too hard to keep control of that land with that very strong horseback army of bow and arrow shooting warriors. So then we go down toward the south. It's okay, we have the northern extent, let's go south. And we went through Central America, and I saw the cities there. And it will surprise you to know that Egypt actually built this city that we call Troy. Troy is in Central America. If you don't know the history of it before they start calling it Troy, you will never find it probably. But when Egypt wrote about it, they actually called it with those same letters. One word was T-R-W, Troy. But they said, well, we have another name for that city. We call it Kuban, K-U-B-B-A-N. It means the hidden city, because Troy is way up from the water at a time where cities, major cities, were being placed on the waterway, because that's how commerce was being conducted, by ship. Troy was not. Troy was up in the rainforest, way up in the mountains, hidden. And so Egypt called it Kuban, the hidden city. And I'm going to give you something I've never told anybody other than close associates. You want to find Troy? You go find the city that Egypt says its name is Kuban. and you'll find this Maya city called Copan, Copan. And there you will have ancient Troy. That's the African city, Troy. So you go further south. You go through Central America. Then you go into South America. I'm looking for Thebes. Now, I've got Memphis, but they said Thebes is Thebes of the West. That's how they wrote it. Thebes of the West. I want to know where it is. And I found it. And the great thing about it is Thebes of the West is the city that David took. That's Jerusalem. It was built to honor the ancient Egyptian ruler, co-founder, the one that most of your listeners will probably recognize as Heru, that others call Horus. The city was built to honor him, and it was laid out in the shape of the hieroglyphic symbol that is his name. When you look in the ancient hieroglyphs that these Africans that we now call Egyptians left, when they wrote the word, the name Heru, it's the hawk in profile, the entire body with the wings on the side that gives you the word H-E-R-U, or Heru. And they laid out the city in that design. It's still there right now today. When you fly above and look down, there is that hawk laid out on the ground, the walls, the streets, the temples, everything that they had laid that they have knocked down, but the foundations are still there. It shows you the outline of the name of the city. It was ancient Egypt's or ancient Africa's. They built a temple there to honor Heru. And some of the listeners and readers will know that one of the words that ancient Egypt used for a temple was per, like a rectangle with an opening in it, almost like a house or a temple. And it was per, P-R, or P-E-R. And so when they have that temple there and they're talking about that place where this famous temple of Heru is, they would say the temple of Heru or Per-Heru. And so now we don't say Per-Heru. We simply say Peru. It's that simple. It's that clear. It's been standing in front of our eyes this entire time. But as long as you let others educate you and tell you what a thing means and you don't test it, you keep teaching the same errors. And that's what was going on. They were getting some knowledge, but they were teaching the errors with the knowledge that they were getting. The Egyptologists knew. But they knew that they were going to hide those Africans. They were going to hide that this was an African civilization because they were trying to justify blacks as being inhuman so that they could make wealth off of them as slaves. And you couldn't say that they were inhuman and uncultivated if you show them with these civilizations. So they distanced them. They divorced the African from the Egyptian histories. Or they attempted to. When they came into the Americas in the 1500s, supposedly stumbling upon it with Columbus, you have to understand Columbus had just returned from West Africa. He had the maps. The same ones that had come over and became what we now call Aztecs, and they hated that. That was a derogatory term. It meant that they worshipped the pagan deity Sutekh that ancient Egypt writes about. So if you're of something, you are a something, you are of it. So they were a Sutekhs or Aztecs. They said, no, we're Christians, we're Muslims, and there are others among us who do worship the traditional beliefs. But they were in a mode of trying to show them as being uncultured and uncivilized. So they knew when they came in the 1500s, they knew where they were. They knew this was Egypt. You find this strange letter in Spain where they're having the wars against the blacks who are now running Spain wars, and they didn't lose that until 1492. And when they defeated those Moors, then they said, now we can go and fight the war against the blacks over in the Americas, but not until we whoop the ones that's on our doorstep or we're on their doorstep. So that's the history that's unfolding. They knew that the Holy Lands were over here, the Vatican knew. And they sent it over to destroy these churches and these people so that the Vatican could be the head of the churches by destroying the other 11 that was in the Americas. And Spain had the right to come in and start trying to get the commerce to become rich off of the gold and the other things in the African cities and with the
slaves. Oh. Okay, now, I had to redo that again because I want every minister of African descent in America to know this, that has a church. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to look now and see if we can drop the so-called Jesus bomb. And let's get that straightened out. I don't know if I can. I definitely don't want to shout. But y'all hold on. Buckle your seatbelts on this one.
We'll take your phone calls with Michael Horn, The Incredible Case of Billy Meyer, next on Coast to Coast AM. Back with Michael Horn, back with your phone calls as well. But, Michael, let's let you finish up about that nighttime photography you were talking about.
Yes, thank you, George. Well, here's the thing. Zahi, Professor Zahi.
Michael, we're going to have to call you back on your cell phone again. This is unacceptable on the air.
Okay. Right here.
So, Tom, call him on the cell phone. Let's hook that up and let's get that going because that is as bad a phone line as I have ever heard. And as soon as you get him, let me know. Let's go to Cornelius, though, and we'll chat a little bit. Corny, you and me.
Oh, Lord, George, I hadn't heard that word since I was in high school, corny.
I bet you were a genius in high school.
Oh, no, far from that, George. Hey, since we can talk for a little bit, have you been out near Ferguson to look around and see what's going on?
Yes, I sure did. I went out there a few weeks ago, and things are calm now. And, you know, the media, Cornelius, blows it out of proportion. It was a smaller, contained area. They make it sound like the entire city of St. Louis was burning. And, you know, the problem out there hasn't gone away, but things are a little calm. Anyways, I think we have Michael Horn back on. So, Cornelius, hold on. I'm going to put you on hold because I want to get back to you with your question. But, Michael, let's see if we got a better connection with you now. Go ahead.
Hi, George. How's this one?
Yeah, that sounds much better. So, okay. Anyways, back to that nighttime photograph. How important is that?
Well, it's super important because, you know, there's been a lot of controversy in the case about the photographs, and people carried on about, where are the negatives and the space photos, which Meyer took over 1,300 of which, and that the, you know, Meyer and the group have had to disavow because it appears that most of them, of course, were stolen, but the ones that survived may well have been manipulated. Okay, so how can the average person, if they're not going to simply take the word of experts, dating back, by the way, to 1980, you have Michael Malin, Mars Mission, who authenticated Meyer's photos. You have several other people. People don't know this. Meyer's photos were authenticated, even his films were authenticated by Nippon TV, but fast forward to today. We have a nighttime photo, a gold object against a black background. Skeptics say, it's just a gold model against the curtain. So Professor Zahi, for whatever reason, takes that photo after he's already proved that the case is real with his 74-page analysis. He takes this particular photo and he drops it into Photoshop. He heightens the brightness, and he lowers the contrast. And what happens, and there's a link to it, people can see this and then do it themselves. Now we see that this is no model against a black background. It is a photograph of a craft taken from above the craft while the craft is hovering over a gravel road that is bordered by a grassy area, a grassy field, and there's a fence post visible. Now, understand this. This is a 35-millimeter film photograph, and it has been circulated on my site and others as a digital image of the 35-millimeter film photograph. You can grab it off of my site and drop it into Photoshop and do it yourself, which is why I said that it'll take you longer to open Photoshop than it will for you to prove to yourself that this is an object photographed in 1981 that was not made on this earth by a man named Billy Edward Albert Meyer while he was in another craft above the object, hovering above a gravel road bordered by a grassy area with a fence post. Now, if people, if they drop this photo and they do it and then they don't get that this is real, then they have to debunk themselves. And Meyer himself never, ever, ever pointed out this photo, and the fact also, something that I discovered several years back that nobody noticed, the dimensions on this craft changed because a part of the craft elevates away from the body of the craft in the nighttime photos. All of this was never mentioned by Meyer. Professor Zahi stumbles upon all of this accidentally, and now literally anybody with a computer loaded with Photoshop can go, I just authenticated the Billy Meyer UFO case. Now, what's the reason for this case, and what are we going
to
do about
it? That's incredible. Okay, now we go to the phones. Cornelius in Louisiana. Hey, Cornelius, go ahead now.
Hey, George. I'm sort of glad you called me Corny. Like I said, I hadn't heard that since high school. Mr. Horn, God bless you, son. Look, I was asking Tommy, and I'm more on biblical prophecy, and I want to know, do you think this follows biblical prophecy? And also, Mr. Horn, I'd like, if you could, at the end of the program, if you have a toll-free number, because I don't have a computer, I'd like to get all that information from your books or in their DVDs. So God bless y'all, and have a nice evening.
All right, let me try to answer that for Cornelius. The information in this case, I have to always say that because there are things I cannot prove. You and I can now prove the case is real, but I can't prove that everything in it is real because some of it pertains to the far distant past, some of it pertains to the as yet unarrived future. Here is information according to this case. According to this case, the real prophecies and predictions of Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Enoch, Elijah, and Jeremiah, and Emmanuel. Cornelius, Emmanuel is the name that Meyer and his extraterrestrial human being friends say was the actual real given name of the man who we call incorrectly Jesus Christ. This is one of the most controversial aspects of the case.
And what do you mean by we call him incorrectly Jesus Christ?
Because according to the information in the case, no man by that name ever lived, and a man named Emmanuel did live. He was crucified. I'll fill in the details. But an interesting thing that has come forward even in the past couple of weeks, there is no historical record for anyone ever named Jesus Christ. And beyond that, there were 60 historians alive during that period living in the overall area, and not one of them ever referred to a man named Jesus Christ, a man who could walk on water and raise the dead, and nobody mentions him as a historian. Interestingly, though, and Cornelius might like this part, when you go into the Old Testament, as I did a bit, just a little bit in the process of my researching all this, I stumbled upon Isaiah 7:14, and his name shall be called Emmanuel. And then, cracking open the New Testament and kind of leafing through, I found, I think it's Matthew 1:23, and his name shall be called Emmanuel. This is one of the things in the Meyer case that has earned Billy the target on his forehead and chest and everywhere else. Here's what happened. In 1964, Billy Meyer knows a man named Issa Rashid, a Greek Orthodox priest living at the time in Jerusalem. Issa Rashid and Billy Meyer are telepathically led to an area that Rashid had been led to before. On the outskirts of old Jerusalem, there's a burn, a small hillside, and Meyer is poking around and finds a small hole, like an opening into this hillside. They dig it, they open it, they are able to enter inside, and what they find themselves in is an ancient, ancient, ancient tomb with stones on the floor. And they go about lifting the stones here and there because Meyer knew there was something there. He had also been told about this before. And what they found, among other things, were several resin-encrusted, animal skin-wrapped scrolls written in Aramaic, a language that Issa Rashid just so happened to be able to read along with German, the language that Meyer speaks. The scrolls were entrusted to Issa Rashid, and he took them back in 1964 and for several years in his spare time worked to translate. By 1970, he sent about a third of these scrolls, which came to be known as the Talmud of Emmanuel, and he sent them, translated into German, to Meyer, who publishes them for the first time in about 1978 in German. In the meantime, between those times, 70-78, Issa Rashid and his family flee from Jerusalem. He writes to Meyer saying, there are people here that have found out that I have these scrolls. I'm not safe. We're going to leave. I'll get back to you if I can. In 1970, well, the next thing that happens is Issa Rashid and his family go into a refugee village in Lebanon, and they hide the scrolls in the wall of a building there. Within 1 week of his arrival with his family in that village and his sequestering the scrolls in the wall, the Israeli military comes in and virtually destroys the entire village. Issa Rashid and his family escape with their lives into Iraq. 4 years later, in 1974, Meyer finds out that Rashid and his entire family had been machine gunned to death, ostensibly by the Mossad. Again, I'm telling the story as we know it. However, in 1978, Meyer publishes the Talmud of Emmanuel and in German. And then in about 1990, the first English translation, these years are important because of things that are in this book. In 1990, James Deardorff finds this book in English, and he says, aha, this looks to me to be a Bible hoax. I'm going to go after it. Now, James Deardorff at the time is a professor at Oregon State University, meteorology, comparative religions, is a very educated man. Within the next 2 years, he comes out with a book called Celestial Teachings, and James Deardorff makes the following claim. The Talmud of Emmanuel is the original document upon which the book of Matthew is based, not the other way around. It resolves over 320 inconsistencies, 250 of which were known, but 120, 150, whatever, weren't known at the time this book was published, and yet it resolves them. For scholars to read this, they are going to have to understand, and they will recognize, if they're honest, this is the original writing. Now, in this book, and what is so potent in here, I know that Cornelius asked about prophecy, so here's something about prophecy, allegedly from the man Emmanuel, who we came to be falsely called, again, according to this, Jesus Christ. He is confronting the scribes and the Pharisees, and he's saying to them, and I've got to paraphrase because I don't have it in front of me, as you have persecuted the true prophets of the past, and those would be, of course, Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, you will persecute me. But in 500 years, another man comes. He will also be a true prophet. And although his teaching will, like mine, be corrupted and falsified, and it will be turned into a false and evil cult, and the followers of that cult will give in the future. Your distant descendants, no peace until the end of time, unless your distant descendants make a just and honorable peace with the distant descendants of the rightful owners of these lands, which you have stolen. Oh boy. So Emmanuel is confronting the scribes and Pharisees and saying, your forefathers stole these lands, and the laws of cause and effect, and all these things, you cannot escape that this will bring bad fruit to you. So unless your distant descendants make a just and honorable peace with the distant descendants of these lands, the Palestinian people, both of these peoples will come to a bitter end. And he describes the destruction of Jerusalem that reads like an atomic holocaust. He says that in these future times, men will make carts that travel on the lands and the sea and in the air. They will create weapons whereby they will hurl the very cornerstones of life, atomic, you know, the atom, against each other. And in certain cases, they will set fire to the oil and it will burn and darken the skies. Do you remember the Gulf War?
Sure do.
Well, this was already published in 1978 in German, and it was ostensibly from the original writing, the original teaching of the man whose name was Emmanuel, who was crucified.
Michael, let me ask you this, though. The Bible does make reference to a Yeshua.
Right. Well, I am not an expert in the Bible, but however, if that name was changed, and it would be for the people who are really, you know, more biblically minded to see if that is correlating with Emmanuel. There are people, you know, there are people that have said, well, his name was, what, Yeshua ben Joseph or this or that. These are things that I am not knowledgeable about, so I can't comment there.
Okay,
I can say that. Yeah, go. I'm sorry, George. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I want to take some more calls here with you. Let's go east of the Rockies. Eli is in Toronto. Go ahead, Eli.
Hi, George, and
hello there.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Eli.
In a way, you kind of answered my question, Michael. What I was going to ask was, in terms of Meyer, how do you see this correlating with the Book of Revelation?
Well, Meyer,
if
the prophecy. I've only looked at that once or twice in my life. What I would say is my recollection, and you may correct me, is that there was a lot of symbolism in Revelation that is open to interpretation, even as, you know, some people may say is the case with Nostradamus. The prophecies and predictions published by Meyer, if we look at the ones of Elijah and Jeremiah, I mean, they're so horrendously specific, where you get in these Henoch prophecies where they're naming America and Russia and all that didn't even exist in those times. But those prophets were powerful, powerful consciousness. They saw into this future. So I cannot answer in terms of Revelation. I would only say that from my perspective, these things that we can look at today and which have been available to us prior to the events occurring are right there for us to think our way through. And if we don't want this stuff to fulfill, if we really don't want this country destroyed, where they go farther, every American city is going to be annihilated, unless we change, and there are ways to do it, yes, it sounds insurmountable, I understand, but we've been trying, you know, for a while to get people to look at this fairly so they'll understand this is not eye candy. This isn't about starting religions or cults or UFO groups or anything. It's about a whole other level. It's warnings from people who have the technology and the capability and are trying, because they have already foretold that by 2020, if we don't change in this country, this is anarchy, and there are two civil wars coming to this country. Meyer published that as far back as 81 and 87. So,
and
I don't
these
know.
Things, can these events be altered? I mean, we have
yes.
free will here, right?
Yes, if we get onto it. If we keep on
kind of slapping ourselves a little bit awake and taking a cold shower and going, okay, let's, are we going to grapple here a little bit? And here's the beauty of it.
Hold on for a second, Michael. We'll hit the break. We'll talk about free will. I want you to tell us what Billy Meyer sees in the future, and we'll take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to be talking about a 3,000-year-old mystery that holds the secret of America's future. Make sure you're part of that program and a special anniversary program as well because of the 13th anniversary of the tragedy of 9/11. We will be back in a moment with Michael Horn as we talk more about the Billy Meyer case, and we'll take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Michael Horn with us. Michael, as controversial as your work is, you got to be congratulated for your really in-depth work and study of Billy Meyer and what he has done.
Well, thanks, George. You know, when you're interested and passionate about something, it's just your pleasure to do it, I guess is the best way to put it. I think you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Hey, Cornelius had wondered if you had a toll-free phone number. Do you have one for those who aren't computer savvy?
No, I've got a 310 number. But
you don't
want to
give that out.
I can give it out. It rings in my computer, fortunately, and not on a regular phone, but if people leave messages, if they don't reach me, I return all my calls and all my email, but I'll give the number out.
Let's do it right at the end of the show.
Certainly.
Okay.
Certainly.
And let me ask you before we take more calls, what prophecy of Billy Meyer has he spoken about in that will affect the future? What do we have the next few years out?
Well, I think if we go back to one of the things we started with earlier pertaining to Russia, Scandinavia, Canada, and the U.S., this is a very clear pattern that we're literally in right now. I probably posted a link on my page that I have for your listeners where they can start to see the updates on the situation between, you know, we're focused a lot on Russia, Ukraine, but what's going on in the Arctic and what's going on with Russia and Scandinavia, the war games that Sweden or Norway are even partaking of, this is happening now. And we don't want to be like deer in the headlights. We don't want to sit, you know, staring at the future coming at us like a freight train and then say to ourselves, well, what's next? Because what's next is just what's next if we don't stop this? There is a world war of a magnitude that we've never experienced before. 3/4 of the population of the world would be lost. The northern hemisphere would be radioactive for years and years, obviously, to come. So, and I don't like to, you know, do the doom and gloom thing.
Okay, Moses, we're back. There you have it in regards to this information. If we have some questions from anybody in regards to what you have heard here this evening, the number to dial in is 310-982-4184, and I will open up the line so that you can get in. We still have one caller that's on, my brother Ishmael out of Nebraska. I'm going to open up his line and see if he's awake with us. Brother, you still with us?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm here, my man. You know, I mean, this is a history lesson everybody should hear. I wanted to ask you something. Did I hear Brother Butler say that when Osiris went to the mouth of the Potomac when they constructed the city? Did I hear him say that he left the obelisk there?
No, that was built later. But what happened was in the parts that we don't understand, that's not being given on the broadcast, is contained in his book, When Rocks Cry Out, Horace Butler. What happened is the Africans, Osiris and them, they did go into the region, and they were there a while. But the whole while they were there, they were constantly coming under, hold on to the region, because what had happened was the Africans in America were pushing and doing the same conquest of things that they had always done to get the region and turn it into good food and introduce fertile land and introduce culture and science and mathematics and all this stuff that they have always done, because that's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But the land was being fought over. Now, you did have other African tribes that were already there. We have to understand this, too. And the situation we're dealing with now is the fact that the entire Old Testament are people of African descent. When you hear any reference in the Old Testament about corn, you know, corn that you eat, the
grows here.
Yeah, the only place on earth during the time period that it grew was in the Americas. So now if we understand that, we can take Ivan Van Sertima's book, They Came Before Columbus, take your Bible and take When Rocks Cry Out, and we can cross-reference the people, places, times, and events. That's the formula that we have to use on this information. And when we do that, we can come to a crystal clear situation about exactly what happened in America, when it happened, who were the people involved, what people did, what, you see. Because we got,
yes,
we got people who attempting to insert themselves in an already existing story. The situation is kind of like a train that is moving down the track, and you have somebody that don't even have a ticket trying to get on the train, who jumps on the train and tell the conductor they've been on the train all the time.
Now, I got a document called the Intercaterra Divina, and it, you know, from my research, the Intercaterra Divina, it's a what you call a papal bulletin that was written, and it tells you when the brother was talking about how the Vatican took over and the other 11 churches was over here. That's the bulletin that they wrote that was concerning Isabel and Ferdinand and Cristoforo Colombo to give them the orders to come over here and so-called kill the rest of us off or convert us to Christianity.
Yeah. Well,
and control the resources, the people, and the commerce.
Well, exactly. That's why they had to, but what they did was they had to go to the heart of certain areas here in this region, which was into Peru, the land that we're calling Peru today, where Jerusalem is, the real Jerusalem. The stuff that they got over going on now, where they talking about the Middle East. First of all, there's no such place. Then you supposed to have these people calling themselves Jews over there and Palestinian, no such thing. Then you, when you go to ancient Kemet, you got people that are being called Egyptians, no such place and no such people. You understand? So what they have done in order to maintain control, they got to remove the original records. We have to destroy the original records. But every once in a while, if you're paying attention, you have somebody up that will jump up and tell the truth. The United Nations wrote in an article in a memo, and I have this thing somewhere. I got to go back through my files so I can repost it so people can read it for themselves, where they have declared the people in Louisiana, oldest people on earth, predating the ancient dynasties of Egypt. Now, notice I ain't say Kemet. I say Egypt. Now,
ain't that the Washita?
Well, we got the Watchtowers. We got a whole. We got a whole lot of people. We got whole states in the United States whose ancient records have been totally covered up and destroyed.
Hmm.
They were dumping whole boatloads of our artifacts into the Atlantic Ocean. And they realized that they're so expensive. So what they have done is they've set up these places, which are nothing more than storage facilities. One of them called the Smithsonian Institute, where when they find these historical records and artifacts and caves and all of this stuff, they would take it to their colleges and universities and examine it. And after they do that, they put it in a box, take it to the Smithsonian Institute, and put it up on a shelf. Because, see, it's the same thing that I was telling people on the previous broadcast. Once you tell a lie, you have to continue to do maintenance on that lie to keep that lie propped up. And this is exactly what's going on. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
When the World Trade Center went down, it's cleaned the ground. They found African ships and stuff. When the brother wrote the book, he took the coin. He went to the churches and stuff, and he tried to get the brothers in the popular churches, pastors and stuff, and he laid out the evidence of what he got contained in the book. And they say, hey, man, mm-hmm. we can't touch this here, man. We ain't got enough energy in us to even touch this kind of fight that you're talking about. Well, it ain't no fight. Because the only time truth come up, when the light of truth come up, darkness gone. That's the end of it. But the problem is we have to have this information so that we can use it. You know, and stop digesting lies or stop standing by letting somebody lie to us. And the broadcast and stuff, even though I have discovered through investigations of my own broadcast right here on Blog Talk Radio that a lot of the truth that I'm telling is being edited out. So it is important for you to get on the broadcast when it's being broadcast live, because after it's broadcast live, it's being edited. I don't see any reason why my broadcast need to be edited. If I got a 3-hour broadcast and I'm closing the broadcast, I might be 1 or 2 minutes over, 2 or 3 minutes over sometimes. Mm-hmm. But so what you need to edit? You need to edit nothing. But what I have found is when I go back and listen to the broadcast, and I'm saying, well, look, I know doggone well I said this right here, but it's missing. Because this was I definitely want to know this, but it's missing. So it's important for us to try to pay attention. And the same identical thing happens on Facebook. Same thing happens on Twitter. Same thing happens on Google+. All over everywhere. The same thing.
Oh, yeah. I posted something last week, historical information last week. From what I got through writing. And when I posted it, I looked at it. There wasn't nothing what I wrote. So I deleted it. And then it started freezing up on me. Well, I couldn't even type, so I just let it alone. I already know, we know what's going on, you know.
Yeah, well, Trojans, viruses, all kind of stuff.
The truth needs no apology, brother.
Well, I did my best to try to tonight to try to bring this information out, and this is something that I want the parents and the teenagers that's listening to this broadcast tonight. Go ahead on and download this. Put it on a CD, a DVD, however you can do it, because you can take a DVD and put it into your stereo, it'll play. You cannot take a DVD and put it in your car on there. But, I mean, you can take a CD, and you know, however way you want to download it, but make sure the children understand this information to get this information down. So those who are in the public school system, when the BS begins, they can have evidence that they can bring to the table to offset the BS and keep the record straight so that you will know the truth. Otherwise, you're going to have to keep digesting a lie. And this broadcast actually have not, even in my opinion, touched the surface of what we need to know. It didn't go into enough detail about everything that we need to know in the Americas or Africa, because our story is the greatest story ever told. Now, the brother did say something that I was proud of him mentioning about the guy that's talking about 22,000 years. I think that's pretty far back. That's pretty good. But you have no idea about how far it goes back in the Americas right here. There are no the only Indians on this landmass come from the continent called India. Okay?
Right.
These people that they label as Indian, that is a lie. They are not Indians.
And they are Hindu. They are Hindustanis.
Huh?
They're Hindustanis.
These people are
kind is not even called India. It's called Hindustan.
Yeah, well, you know, we refer to them as Indians. I look at it this way. I say, okay, well, I'll go for labeling you as Indians.
Yeah.
And you got the land and it's called India. That's on the map. I go for that because that's associated with landmass. And we are referring to Caucasians as white people. There's no such thing. Where's white land? Now we know where the Caucasus Mountains is that contain the caves. We know where that is. So we're dealing with Caucasians. But anyway, brother. We're coming down to the end of the broadcast, man. I appreciate you being here with me. And let's get this stuff out, get it downloaded, embedded, put it on your website, do everything you can with it. And we're going to come back with some more of this in the future. But we wanted to cross-reference between Africa and America so that everybody can get this down, so that we can understand this.
Yes, sir.
I recommend everybody go get the book, When Rocks Cry. Take your time and read it, cross-reference, get your Bible, get your pastor, put them on the side, look at it. I need to talk to you a minute, and I need you to give me a microphone, let me hold it a minute so I can get up here and set this in a record straight. Through the little Jesus part in there, you know, so we get that part straight too, a part of it, because he didn't go into the alphabet J and all of that we need to go into, but anyway, we get to that later. But I thank you, brother,
That's exactly what I plan to do. I'm going to go around to a couple of ministers that I know pretty good. I grew up with, actually.
Yeah.
They're good people, and I'm going to let them hear this broadcast.
Okay, well, slip it to them, and, you know, don't get mad with them when they tell you not to come back to the
church. I won't.
Okay. All right, brother.
Islam.
Islam, bro. All right. Hey. Ladies and gentlemen, we're coming to the end of the broadcast. I certainly hope you all got something out of this thing. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana LB, and until next time, you have a good day.
Whoa, whoa. Yeah.
I thank God for